afternoon. This is our last oral argument for the November sitting. And according to my notes, we have some North Central Technical College students here. Would they stand so we can meet them? Well, thank you for coming, and you may be seated. If you have not already received summaries of this case, have you received any? Fine. For everyone, they have received summaries of this case. We conduct the Court with Class program at the State Bar, which is a national award-winning program, of which we're very proud. And there are summaries of this case for anyone who would like a summary outside in the foyer on one of the tables. Now that we've met the students from North Central Technical College, I would like to introduce the court to all of you. On my far right is Justice Patrick Crooks. He is seated next to Justice John Wilcox. On my immediate right is Justice Donald Steinmetz. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. On my immediate left is Justice William Babbage. Next to him is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. And next to her is Justice David Prosser. With the introductions made, I will call 7-1997 James Schwab et al. Versus Helen Timmons et al. And as I have the oral argument before me, Mr. Lyons will have 15 minutes representing James Schwab, Mr. Elrod 10 minutes representing Doris McCormick, Mr. Reitz will have 15 minutes representing the Carl D. Lenz Trust, Mr. Ross 15 minutes representing Helen Timmons, and Mr. Lyons will make rebuttal. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Okay, then we'll
he says no.
Who do you represent, sir?
I represent the U.S.
Okay.
Your family.
Okay. Spare us reading it. Thank you. All right. Thank you. Counsel?
Good afternoon. I will address the court regarding the policy issues of the easement and landlocked property as it applies to these facts. Mr. Elrod will address the court regarding the historical law of easements. What the petitioners are seeking today is access to their property and to be able to reasonably use the property, including the addition of the utilities. We have blown up and brought for the court Diagram 1, which is a part of the appendix, and I believe you all have a copy in front of you. The petitioner's property is in Lot 2, Government Lot 2. It is landlocked. It is landlocked for two reasons. One, geographical barriers with the cliff on the north and the east, the waters of Green Bay on the west. It is landlocked on the south due to the respondent's property. Due to the action of the United States government in 1854, in which the government transferred Lot 4 and did not retain a way of access for Lots 2 and 3. In 1882, the government transferred Lots 2 and 3. Since 1982, Lots 2 and 3 have been owned by private individuals and have been landlocked.
A question, Counsel.
Yes, Your Honor.
In 1882, did the government, when they transferred lots 2 and 3, was that transferred to one owner or more?
It was one owner at that time.
So one owner then owned lots 2 and 3.
Correct.
And then when did that one owner transfer lot 2 or 3?
Your Honor, between that time and in the early 1900s, it was transferred a number of times back and forth.
But I'm talking about the first time. I'm interested as to whether or not when you had a complete property, a unified property of lots 2 and 3, when it was transferred for the first time, was it lot 3 that was transferred or lot 2 that was transferred? And would that be relevant to this case in terms of easement by necessity?
Hey. In answer to your question, I am not aware of what was transferred first. And the reason I am not aware is I don't believe it's relevant. Okay. The relevant aspect of this case is that both 2 and 3 are landlocked properties. The properties in question are those in the bottom half of 3 and in lot 4. In fact, some of the respondents are in actually lot 2. So it is immaterial for our argument, or at least the petitioner's argument, that that lots 2 or 3 were transferred at all, since they were transferred from the United States in 1882.
Maybe I don't understand the law of easement by necessity, but it seems to me that if the one owner who owned lots 2 and 3 transferred lot 2 and kept lot 3, you might very well have had an easement by necessity created right then and there.
That's probably true, Your Honor. However, it's immaterial because we need an easement over all of the properties. One of the respondents objecting to an easement will not.
You need easement over lot 4 and lot 3.
Correct. If we had an easement over all but one of the respondents' properties, we would fail.
Gotcha. What's happening on the north? If I recall correctly, it's rocky, huh? But it's not cliff.
It's not. It goes to an area on the north, which is rocky, which makes it improbable to travel. There is a way, the record is silent on this, but there is a way to walk over it, but there is absolutely no way that this property would be, or that a road would be able to put in, or fire departments, emergency vehicles.
Just for my edification here, as I recall, this is about a 9-acre parcel.
Yes.
And what is it? It borders totally. How much frontage is there in this?
There's in excess for both petitioners in excess of 1,200 feet.
Thank you,
Mr. Lyons. When did your client purchase this property?
My client inherited and was gifted the property at two different times from his parents. One in 1965, and then again in 1974.
And when did his parents obtain it?
His parents obtained the property in the 1940s.
Presumably it was landlocked at that time.
The property in question is landlocked, Your Honor. The parents also own property above the cliff. But the property that we are, and that I would also tell the court, is immaterial to our argument. We are dealing with substantial economic value and societal value of opening lands below the cliff. And it's immaterial whether the property was owned, who the property was owned with above the cliff.
Who owns the property at the top of the cliff now?
The property at the top of the cliff from the Schwabs is owned by a relation to him, and the property above the McCormick's is owned by an independent third party. I would point out that it is impossible to use that as a common grantor in order to have access to this property. And that was pled in the complaint, and it is established by the facts of the complaint, as set out in the complaint.
Counsel, to be frank with you, the reason I'm interested in it is I'm just wondering why somebody would buy landlocked property like that.
Well, they didn't buy it, Your Honor. They were given the property or inherited the property. The Schwabs that bought it, the parents that bought it, bought the entire parcel.
So they had access from the other side.
Well, they could not. They had access to the above the cliff, but they had no access to the below the cliff either. The cliff below the cliff has never had access.
Presumably their house was above the cliff.
It was, yes.
Sounds like pretty nice property.
It is. This private road, if the court will notice, in lot 4, below lot 4 is a public road. A private road then proceeds north from lot 4, and it proceeds into lot 2. There are 15 of the respondents who have the private road over their entire property. There is one respondent that has the private road over half the property. The last respondent is a lady by the name of Timmons, whose attorney at the trial court did not object to the petitioner's request at the trial court. She does not have a road at all, but she has no objection to the proceedings.
She owns the property immediately adjacent to Lot 2?
She owns the property immediately adjacent to the Schwab property, immediately south. They're all in Lot 2.
Now, you went through an 80-13 procedure, correct? Not you, but someone.
The Schwabs went through an 80-13 procedure.
And that was through the village of Ephraim.
Correct.
And I found it interesting, as I understand the statute, they have, it's a discretionary call.
Correct.
And they, for some reason, decided that this was not in, as they call it, the public interest. Public interest.
Correct.
Which I found...
My comment, Justice, would be that under Backhausen, is very clear that this does not preclude the easement by necessity because it is discretionary. If there was an absolute right for the Schwabs to get the road through the public road, then yes, they would be prohibited from going an alternative way. However, in this situation, the village, I would determine it to be more of a political interest as opposed to the public interest. And the reason being is it's discretionary. We don't know why the village decided not to put the public road. It could be because they didn't want asphalt road. It could be because they didn't want additional maintenance requirements, additional cost. They may have had to hire another maintenance man because they had too much additional roads. It was a political decision and not one of legal decision, which we're asking you to...
If it's a political decision, just like all discretionary, couldn't it have been attacked on the fact that it was arbitrary and capricious?
It was attacked and it was upheld.
Okay. All right.
The Schwabs exhausted not only their administrative remedies in that way, but I would assure you we've exhausted all remedies of negotiation too.
Counsel, is it you that I should ask or Mr. Elrod this question? So you can pass it on if you don't want to respond, if you're not in a position to respond. I want to know what elements have to be averred in order to maintain a cause of action for easement of necessity, and what elements have to be averred in order to maintain a cause of action for easement of implication.
Your Honor, I'll address the first one, and I'll leave the second to Mr. Elrod. For an easement for necessity, we must have common ownership under Wisconsin's current law. Most importantly, Wisconsin is silent as to the two issues that will be more prevalent when Mr. Elrod speaks, and that is whether or not the U.S. can be a common owner, and second and most importantly, whether or not a geographical landlocking, in effect, creates the landlocked property.
Is it correct that unless you prevail on the proposition that the U.S. can be the common ownership, that you lose on the easement of necessity for lack of common ownership? Is that correct?
I believe without an expansion of the law, that is correct. But I am asking the court, the petitioners are asking the court today to expand that law because we believe that the law is no longer relevant in its present form. The law was set up, there is no rational basis to have landlocked property in this state in the 1990s. The court, in our belief, should determine a reasonable use test and balance the interest of both the property on one side that needs the easement, and I would purport to tell the court that balancing should be as to benefit and need. The benefit to society of developing properties and lands, which this court has repeatedly from 1875 in the Dillon case, has in fact, it's a well-established policy. The property now, revolt properties are now being developed. This property went for 145 years without a need. And now the property is worthless to well, society, to the landowner, has no economic value without an easement. And our position is that this court should find when the circumstances, such as the facts in this case, geographical barriers, and when there is a need and a benefit, and that need and benefit outweighs the detriment to the property. The respondents, 15 of them have a road over their property now. One of them, we're going to have to extend the road a little bit at the base of the cliff. It won't get anywhere near their property. We weigh those. The courts weigh competing interests every day. And when you weigh that, the court will and should determine that the benefit to society and to the land of opening this land far outweighs any detriment it has.
Okay. Also, that may well be the case, but we don't even reach that weighing if we can't do it legally. We need a legal basis, and you just said that there must be common ownership, and we are going to have to expand the law as to whether or not the United States can be a common owner. And, you know, if we answer that no, we'll never reach those policy questions. So I'd like you to talk just a few minutes, if you would, about what this common ownership is all about and why you think that law should be expanded to include the United States.
Well, I think in this particular fact situation, it should especially be expanded, and that is because the United States created this problem. The United States is the one that landlocked the property. Now, in all fairness to the United States, in 1982, when they created the problem by the last transfer, up until 1940s is when there was transfer of easements among the respondents. So for 60-some years, all these people went back and forth on this property by handshake. So it wasn't prevalent in the mind of the United States or in the mind of any of these people for 60-some years. And so today, when we're seeing remote lands being opened up, there is no rational basis for a common ownership at all. But if the court is not willing to take that big step and abolish the common ownership requirement, I would say that in the facts before the court here, and I think, quite frankly, that in the near future, that step will be taken. But in the facts before the court today, there's no question that the United States caused this. By way of correlation, Justice, it seems absurd to me that this property, 1,200 frontage, as well as other property, it's a deep lot, can be developed, that because the government made a mistake or intentionally did something 145 years ago, that we as a society are going to not develop this property, not now and not ever.
When you say develop, and I was looking in the blue brief here, I see there's an estimate here of, to construct the road would cost $700,000. And I'm just wondering if the cost of the road was $100,000, would you be here? In other words, there is an alleged access. The problem that I see is that it's $700,000. Is that cost something that you're saying that you would do another way if it was less?
No, because the cost was by affidavit at the trial court that we would not do it because a road going over this large hill would destroy two properties. It would, because of the way the angle would have to be engineering wise, it would have to destroy the property up above, and the slant down would make it the property below worthless. In addition, I don't have any engineering background in this area, but I would assume that the fire department emergency vehicles would refuse to respond because of that road.
Well, the reason I ask is because under 8013, and I practiced law before I came here many years ago, and as I recall, if you wanted to go across someone's property, but you had access in some other way, there was a strong possibility that they would deny because you do have access, I won't say regardless of the cost, but there was access. Say you didn't want to travel, you wanted to go across this 100 feet rather than travel a quarter of a mile to get to your property. And that's why I asked the question as to the value of building a road and what it would
be. Yeah. I would go back at the cost. At some cost, obviously, it could be done. I would tell the court that it is a reasonable basis, and that's why I'm asking the court to use the reasonable test.
Are there any other questions for Mr. Lyons? Justice Prosser.
In 1882, the United States granted lots 2 and 3 to Mr. Anderson. Is that right?
Correct.
Does lot 2, do lot 2 and lot 3 stop at the cliff?
No. The cliff runs below, or the road runs below the cliff.
So the answer is that those lots do stop at the bottom of the cliff.
What I want to know is this. It's 1882.
Right.
The United States government grants some property to Mr. Anderson. Did they grant him property below the cliff and above the cliff?
Yes.
All right. Then weren't there actions by Mr. Anderson, in effect, to cut off the bottom? It wasn't the government. It was the... Can't you get to the top of the cliff easily enough from
you
a road?
You can today.
Okay.
Yes. No.
And so isn't it action by Mr. Anderson that cut off the shoreline?
No. Because you can't get from the cliff to the property below, either when Mr. Anderson or the government owned it or now. Our position is not so much of the common ownership doctrine. This is why we're asking the court to expand it. It's because geographically, you can't get from above the cliff to below the cliff. It's an impossibility, and vice versa. So when Mr. Anderson owned it, sure, he could build his cottage up here and go out, but he could not use over one half of his property below. And now, the property is owned by different individuals above and below. But I would purport to tell the court that if Mr. Schwab owned both up and below, I would be standing here today asking you for exactly the same relief because of the geographical barrier.
Mr. Lyons, has any other jurisdiction adopted the reasonable needs test that you're asking us to adopt?
The one that has come closest, Your Honor, and in fact, this fact situation is very close, is in Texas. In the case that is cited, which is Teach versus Habby.
Is that a geographical barrier case also?
It was a geographical barrier. In fact, it was the example I just used to Justice Prosser, that in that case, there was one half of the property had rocks and was inaccessible. This individual owned both sides of the property. He had access to the public road below on one side of the property. He had no access on the other side. The court, in that case, granted him access because it was reasonable.
There's another question, Justice
Babb. Thank you, Chief. One quick question. That 60 years in which there was access by way of handshake or just agreement, why does that not give some right? I don't know easement law, but it's somewhere in the back of my mind, there's something about that...
Implied.
An implied easement or something.
Prescriptive easement. Well, we are not able to show, because it's overgrown, and we cannot show any road. The road, by virtue of the... by looking at it, you'll see the road stops at the Lenz property, and we did not feel that we can show that the road was used to that extent.
Well, you can show that it was used right up to that line, though, can't you?
Absolutely. But that doesn't solve our problem. Once again, we got to get that last half of the lot, because if we miss 1 foot along this entire area, we lose. We fail.
Besides, if it was a handshake, it's not adverse possession. Whenever the handshake is broken, then you're gone. It's like a lease.
Right.
Okay. Counsel, you've used your time. Mr. Elrod.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You'll have time for a rebuttal.
Thank you. My name is Richard Elrod, and my firm represents Therese McCormick, the other property owner at the base of this cliff seeking access. My first response will be to Justice Bradley's question on the easement by implication. It involves an open and notorious use prior to the land being split up that continues after the land being split up. So that's the adverse possession type use. And again, there isn't an open and notorious road that goes back into these remote properties. And so the only way that argument could be made in this case would be by the grant in 1882 to Halvor Anderson of 2 and 3 and his crossing lot 4 to get to his lots 2 and 3. There may be an argument of implication over lot 4, but that still doesn't get us to our properties that far north.
Let me ask then, is it correct to say it's your position that you did not allege the elements of an easement by implication in your amended complaint?
My understanding was that both types of easements were alleged, that there was the allegation of an easement existing, and then the clarifications came later as to necessity and implication.
I'm missing something then.
Okay.
What? I thought that you had to allege, you said, essentially open and notorious use prior to the separation of the properties. Is that your understanding of
That's
the elements
right.
that have to be alleged?
That's correct. Those
or
are the elements
easement,
for easement by implication.
Did you allege those?
I specifically can't answer that question without pulling out the complaint and looking at it.
But even if you failed to allege them, then is it not correct that you failed? If you failed to allege those elements, wouldn't you agree then that the conclusion that you failed to assert a cause of action of easement by implication is a correct assertion?
If the court finds that to be true, when there is the allegation that an easement exists without setting forth what type of easement that it is. What we're asking the court to do at this point in time is to expand the law of the easement of necessity, as it were, to allow the United States to be considered a common grantor. We've talked about the reasonable use type test and the court in Texas that's adopted that. There's a case that we've cited the court to, a Weiss case, it's called, from Missouri, that does just this in a very similar situation where there's a geographical land lack of the land and a farmer who can't, because of a stream and boulders and a cliff, have access to the area above the cliff. The court there adopted the doctrine that allows the United States to be the original grantor and therefore the common grantor for purposes of easement and necessity. And the court gives a real good example of how that's done, showing a block of 9 lots with the middle lot being the guy that doesn't have access to the outside, and saying that the United States had to imply that that middle lot had access. And we're arguing the same thing in this case, that the United States had to imply when it granted 2 and 3 to Mr. Anderson that he had access across lot 4 to get to 2 and 3, even though that may not have been expressly reserved. We acknowledge case law on both sides of this issue, and it's an issue that this court hasn't had opportunity or hasn't taken opportunity specifically to decide up to this point. And it seems to me the common thread in the opposing case law is a concern that I would refer to as kind of a slippery slope argument, that if we granted this right for the United States to be a common grantor, everybody would have access to everybody's land, because at some point in time the United States owned everything. That fails to see the point of what an easement by necessity is by definition, though. An easement by necessity means there's no other way that's practical or reasonable to have access to your property. It's that same example with the 9 lots, a block of 9 lots. It's only the middle fellow that might have an opportunity for an easement by necessity, because everybody else has access because they're on the outside. It's not as though the 8 folks on the outside get to go across everybody's lot back and forth and have a free-for-all. That misses the whole definition of what an easement by necessity is, and I think that that's a limitation that the court can put on and ought to put on what's being requested here with the United States as a grantor. And the next step beyond that is something Mr. Lyons has discussed with the court, and that's allowing the court to use a balancing of the equities test as a part of that definition of necessity. Necessity has inherent in it a balancing of the equities. Is it necessary to get out? Is it more fair, as one of the justices brought up, that you travel the extra mile to go around because you can get to your property that way? And that's not the case in this situation. Because of geography and because of the United States choosing to grant as they granted, there is no access in this situation.
Counsel, if I might, just a moment.
Certainly.
Back to Justice Pross's question, if I understood it in your response.
Show me where the eastern boundary line is of lots 2, 3, and 4.
The current...
Just go up. When this was transferred out, I mean... I see where you have the cliff. Where's the boundary line?
When these were originally transferred, yes, the boundary line was at some point above the cliff. It was admittedly above the cliff.
Okay, and so was there access then for 2, 3, and 4 above the cliff?
There was access above the cliff. And there is a road that currently runs above the cliff at this point in time, but it's a 60-foot cliff, and so you can't get from the top down and from the down
but
up.
This was a much wider lot than shown in this map.
It was a wider lot, correct,
and
continuing.
Access from other end, that is, from the eastern end, even though there's not access now from the western end.
There was access to the above portion, but never access to the lower portion.
Council, can you climb that cliff? Can the people walk up and down?
Not safely. If you're a rock climber, I'm sure you could climb that cliff. I wouldn't venture the attempt.
Could you tell me what is the depth of these lots or average depth of the lots?
I know that the property is owned by Schwab and McCormick, total approximately 9 acres. The McCormick property eventually narrows down to where it's just rocky and the cliff and the edge of the water are relatively close together. I don't know the specific depth of those lots at this point.
Mr. Elrod, when did your client buy the property?
Justice Crooks, my client inherited the property through family again some time ago, similar to the scenario that the Schwabs dealt with, and it also did at that point in time include the land above the cliff, which was subsequently transferred.
Thank you.
And the lower portion was retained.
So, Mr. Olaf, just so that I understand your theory here, you are saying that when the government transferred Lot 4, they maintained an easement by necessity of lots 3 and 2.
When the government... I'm sorry.
Is that it? Is that what the... I'm trying to put in a nutshell that I can understand what your theory is.
I think it's the other way around.
Okay, come back.
The government transferred Lot 4 and retained Lots 2 and 3. At a subsequent... And it, when it did that transfer, it had no access to that portion of Lots 2 and 3 below the cliff. The only way it could have access is by reserving unto itself an implied easement. It obviously didn't, formally reserve that easement. There's no express easement. But it had to reserve some access unto itself to get there. And the argument is, based upon the general law of easements, is that it's an appurtenance to the land. It transfers with the land, despite the fact that there may be many, many owners in some interim time period.
But isn't the doctrine ordinarily that had the government owned Lot 4 and then transferred out 2 and 3 to somebody else and transferred landlocked property, that's an assumption, then the assumption is that the owner of Lot 4, the government, gave an easement to 2 and 3.
Correct.
And this is just the opposite situation.
Correct.
And that's what your problem is.
That's what our problem is.
And if it were the way I had just described it, you wouldn't be here because you would have an easement by, now I have forgotten the terms, is it implied or
necessity?
Necessity. Okay. So that would have been it.
But you still would face the question if whether or not the government under case law can be the, has unity of title, can be the common denominator.
Exactly. That's an issue that has to be determined first, and if that's determined, then you move on to the steps of applying that concept and seeing if, based upon the equities and necessities, the easement ought to be granted.
When you talk about equities and necessities, I almost want to bite my lip because it might not be, it just comes, I'm being honest. One of the equities is that probably people aren't going to pay much for landlocked land, or they're going to get it an inheritance. I mean, they're not out a lot. Let me ask this, is that a proper consideration for this court to look at when it's weighing the equities, and if not, why not?
if the court's going to do a balancing test, as Mr. Lyons talked about, I think all facts that may have any relevance to the situation ought to be weighed. In this case, that may very well be true, is that this land, as it sits, has a much different value than as it sits with the ability to develop it. But you have to keep in mind the public policies that are in favor of developing the land and the changes in the land use. At one point in time, nobody probably cared that there was no access to this bottom land because it wasn't desirable and sought after land as it is now.
So that's one of the equities, whether this could be developed into some type of housing or commercial or whatever.
I would submit that it is. And another one of the equities would be what burden does it represent to allow that development to the lots? And it is essentially, aside from the Lenz property that would need some new road extended for a short distance, it's just use of an existing road.
But how do...
One question. I would assume this property is being taxed by the local government.
It is. And to be honest, it's also zoned as single-family housing land.
So Kmart
is regulated. There's not going to be a Kmart there, correct.
Justice Press.
Do you know, Mr. Elrod, in lots 4, 3, and 2, when the first property was built on the shore?
On the lower portion? To be honest, sir, I don't, on that lower portion. There have been houses there for quite a few years, but I don't have an answer as to when the first one went out.
I'm going to make a comment and then ask Mr. Lyon to address it when his turn comes. Strikes me that this drawing is troubling to me, because originally that lot was much deeper to the east, and it had access. And this is a later created problem when it started to be divided along the cliff and you had people own different parts of it. So.
I think that's just for
Lyons. I have a question.
All right.
It's our last oral argument, so pepper you.
Thank you.
We have in this state a lot of islands that are privately owned. And in order for people to utilize those islands, they have to get to them by boat. Crab Lake up north, for instance. Now, I take it that Government Lot 2, as well as the McCormick property, is accessible by boat. Is it not?
If you could build a pier out into the waters of Green Bay far enough to safely get there, there may be access by boat. There is case law that's been cited to the court talking about that issue. On an island, that's the reasonable use of the island property, is accessed by boat. In a property like this, the reasonable use or the reasonable means of obtaining access to it is by driving, because somebody's going to live there and use it on a day-in and day-out basis.
Well, are you telling me that it's impossible to access Lot 2 and McCormick's by boat?
I'm not telling you that it's impossible to get there by boat. It's impractical.
Well, I know that it's difficult.
Sure.
But I mean, it's difficult to reach islands too, and it's a pain in the neck because, you know, you got to load up your boat, but it goes on all the time.
And the court looked at that case in the Hancock case that was cited to the court, saying that the modern view for sound reasons of social policy is that a way of necessity may exist over the land of the grantor, even though the grantee's land borders on a waterway, if the water route is not available or suitable to meet the requirements of the uses to which the property would reasonably be put.
And is that true, that single-family housing would not be a reasonable use?
It would be a very reasonable use of that property. If you could get to it, I would love to have my house there.
But by boat?
by boat, I would say that it's not on a practical basis to get to the office in the morning.
One more question, because you raised this about the utilities. In other words, water, well, strike that. At least electricity. And is that a problem also?
There's going to have to be an easement to allow access for underground utilities, and we would submit to the court that that really presents little to no additional burden extending the existing pipes underground, as the impact is. And there has been case law, specifically the Atkinson case, a very recent case from this court, actually the Court of Appeals, addressing easement by easement for utilities.
Thank you, Mr. Elrod.
Thank you.
Mr. Reitz.
Good Good afternoon, Your Honor. Your Honors. My name is Brett Reitz, and I am here on behalf of the Carl D. Lenz Trust. My portion of the argument is going to be focused on rebutting the arguments of the petitioners. Mr. Ross, who represents the Barrett family at Al, is going to play cleanup for today's purposes, and he's going to go over our positions and hit four important points. The first rebuttal that I'd like to make to their argument is addressed to their argument that they are entitled to an easement by necessity. They would ask this court to ignore the law that requires unity of title or go back and find that the fact that the government, the federal government, owned the land at one time, that satisfies the unity of title requirement. It's important to note, and it's something that wasn't clear in their arguments, that the government retained Lot 2 and gave away Lot 3 and 4. Under Wisconsin law, that would require the government to reserve an easement in Lot 3 and 4 for themselves, which they did not do. If it were any other private party in the same circumstances, regardless of time, and they did that, they would not have an easement by necessity. And if you look at the Rock Lake case, it says that exactly, where somebody deeded away portions of their property, thereby landlocking the grantor, and the court said that they do not have a right to an easement by necessity based upon that act.
Counsel, I understood your opposing counsels to say originally when this property was conveyed that it had access because it was deeper lots.
Mm-hmm.
Boy, that strikes me that if that's correct, then there is no easement by necessity, not only legally, but factually, because they had access when it was conveyed.
Well, Your Honor, I would agree with that. In fact, I don't think it's in the record, but the Schwabs and McCormicks, to some extent, created their landlocked condition. If we are to accept their argument, you create a situation where a person could own a large parcel of land and say, for example, I can't get to the back corner of my land because there's a wetland or a bluff. And if you adopt their argument, they could ostensibly sue their way out through their neighbor's yard because of this geographic condition. We submit that result would create mayhem in Wisconsin real estate law. No longer would you just be looking at boundary lines to determine the landlocked nature of a parcel. You'd be looking at, have to look at the geography of land. And not just the geography of the land that is just next to you, but as in a case like this, the geography of the land that is 19 parcels away, more than almost a mile away. It would just wreak havoc to Wisconsin real estate law.
Counsel, as I understand it, Government Lot 4 was the first to go.
That's correct,
1854. But the government retained title to Lots 2 and 3.
Yes.
At the time. Well, it seemed, putting aside for a moment the law,
okay,
just talking about common sense, but doesn't it make sense that the government maintained or by implication or some way kept access to Lots 2 and 3 over Lot 4? Why would anybody be so dumb as to sell a lot and thereby landlock themselves if the government was a private entity?
I think at that time we have to consider the mechanism that the land was surveyed by the government, which was rather primitive. It was there probably were not roads to all lots. They weren't looking at that. They weren't, when they deeded a lot, just the practical ramifications of saying we've got to make sure there is access to this lot would be an insurmountable task to effectively deed all lots with access and give them easements.
Mr. Reitz, maybe I don't understand the facts again, but when the government deeded out 4, it wasn't as you drew it there, or whoever drew that. It was far to the east of that.
That's right.
And that would not be landlocked.
No, absolutely.
You could get out on the east. It's only landlocked, if I understand the facts, because you have drawn parcels now at the bottom of the cliff. But that parcel, Government 4, and I don't know, government law, if the answer to my questions is right, is not a landlocked parcel. And 2 and 3 is originally drawn and is originally conveyed by the federal government was not landlocked. You got out that way.
That's absolutely correct.
And so when were these lines drawn and parcels sold below the cliff?
That's right.
When?
When were the lines drawn below the cliff?
Yeah. Now,
do you mean when were the parcels split so that there was property of varying years? I mean, there's 19 parcels from the lot 4 to lot 3, so various times.
The guys that owned the eastern end split off and sold that on the water.
Right.
And then they made deals to give each other access, apparently.
Apparently, yes.
And the deal wasn't cut for lot 2 below the cliff, apparently.
It was not cut for lot 2 with the exception of the Lenz property, who is my client, where the driveway ends halfway into their property.
Okay. So it's not landlocked when it's originally sold out by the government.
It is not landlocked at that point. That's correct, Your Honor.
So we don't even have to get the code. I mean, this was what I thought Justice Prosser was asking. And so you don't have co-owners. You don't have a single unitary owner of landlocked land. When the government had it, it was not landlocked. I mean, if I understand the facts.
What?
And that was the point of that question.
Could I ask you a question?
Sure.
I'm sure my colleagues know the answer to this, but I don't know the answer. Why can't the parties come to any agreement about this?
Well, there's a lot of reasons, and most of which are not in the record. But the petitioners have ostensibly about almost 1,600 feet of shorefront, valuable shorefront. They could build quite a few houses there. The nature of this road, and it's been called the road, that is an overstatement. By the time it gets to my client's property, it is a very, very narrow driveway, road. Well, it's a path almost, or a logging road, a narrow driveway that just terminates in my neighbor's, halfway into my neighbor's yard. At some points along the road, it is so narrow, wedged between an upper cliff and a lower cliff, that there's turnouts for cars to pull over to when they pass. To say that it's a road and they're just extending it a little bit is not accurate. The other thing, because of the nature of the cliff, many of the homes are very close to the road. So to extend the easement further, which Wisconsin law does not permit at present, and allow that additional development would be a very big burden on the respondents in this matter, because they would have additional traffic going right, in some cases, right behind their houses. That is one of the reasons that there hasn't been an agreement, and there's been some bad blood as well.
Have you tried mediation?
No. I have not I'm not aware of it since I've been involved in this case, Your Honor.
Has anybody considered a restrictive covenant on those, on McCormick and the Schwab property, that only one home can be built on each piece of property?
That has not been proposed, to my knowledge.
Okay, Mr. Reitz, you may continue, sorry.
Okay.
Justice Prosser.
Is there evidence that, let's say, the McCormicks just want to develop all of this and have 10 properties there, or 10 lots, and what they have now, or whatever you can legally
do? I don't know of that, no. I don't know that there's any evidence that they intend to, you know, build a miniature Disney World on that property or anything like that. But I do know that they could build a significant amount of single residential homes, which would put an extreme burden on a very narrow road, very narrow private road that comes very close to existing houses. As a matter of public policy, and as much as I'm here to protect my client, I feel like I'm here to protect other landowners in the country. If you do today what the petitioners would ask you to do, in the future, when a person buys a parcel of property, they're not only going to, when they do the title search, they're going to have to go a mile away, 2 miles away, check those chains of titles, see who granted what to what, see who's landlocked, look at geographical barriers. You're going to jeopardize the security of lenders. This forum here today, there's a provision in the legislature for them to get access. They tried. I'd point out also the McCormicks did not try. Just the Schwabs went to the village of Ephraim. There's a provision that the legislature set forth to allow them to get access to the land. One party availed themselves of that, and they were denied. The statute, it contemplates that it's discretionary on the town board. What we have here ostensibly is an action in private condemnation. My clients could not have known of this eventuality when they purchased their land years back, because under the statute and case law, a bona fide purchaser for value just has to go to the courthouse, they have to check their deed, go to the courthouse, check public records, and go out on the land and look. If any of these 19 families had done that, they would have never have known that this possibility existed. They would not have been able to have notice of this. In fact, the petitioners have conceded the road ends. At best, if the person at the south end of the road walked to the north end, he would see that the driveway ended, and to that extent he would have notice from actually looking at the road. But to put the burden on property purchasers to investigate parcels up to a mile away to see if that parcel potentially is landlocked, and if that parcel potentially would find the most feasible way out through their land, it just seems like an unbearable burden for that. The other thing is,
what would this do to 8013? Anything? 8013 being the discretion of the towns and the villages to either grant a highway road or not.
Well, I think what this would do to 8013 is it would give people an option. And they would be able to say, we can go to the town and see if we can get a public road, or we can sue our neighbors and try and get out. I think it gives them an alternative to 8013, which I don't think was the intent of the legislature.
Could I ask one question? Does 8013 apply to a unit of government other than a town?
Your Honor, I don't know the answer to that.
It does talk about supervisors of any town, and Ephraim is a village, is it not?
Yes, it is.
I mean, does everyone agree that this statute applies to a village?
I don't think that has ever been disputed in this case, and certainly one of the petitioners has exercised their rights under 8013 and has been denied.
Mr. Reitz, what about the argument that from a public policy point of view, that property ought to be able to be used, and that the position taken by your clients and Mr. Ross's clients is denying use of this property?
That's absolutely not their position. What their position is that the petitioners do not have the right to extend an easement through their yard or expand the use of existing easements for the benefit of the petitioner's property. This property is not without value. Door County is riddled with island property accessible only by water. It has value. Islands.
Is this a rocky shore?
I believe, yeah, it's not a beach, it's a rocky shore, yeah. Not like Cape Point or where there's huge rock bluffs, but just a gravelly, rocky shore.
Is it accessible by boat?
I'm a boater, and in the right days you could access it, sure.
From where?
Sure. As much as you could in certain properties on, say, Chambers Island, or Middle Island in the Strawberry Chain, or islands in and about Bailey's Harbor, sure. Sure. It's not a useless piece of property by any means. By any means. And it has value. And it's to point out that the bluff situation in Door County, people have used elevators to get down bluffs, and they've created staircases to get down bluffs to access that property. There are other ways to access this property. The argument of the petitioners that we should consider the $700,000 cost as landlocking that property is very, very problematic, because it forces the courts to craft some sort of subjective test or analysis of wealth. You could imagine a situation where a person of moderate means has a small parcel, and maybe it's a little cheaper for them to go through a neighbor's yard than to maybe build a little bridge over a swale to access a road. They could come in with the same argument, and instead of talking about $700,000 as creating a landlocked condition, we'd be talking about maybe $5,000. The pun or the slippery slope comment was made, but this is a slippery slope argument that the petitioners are making.
Oh, one question, factual question. I think you went into it before, but I can't pull it out of my memory. The Schwabs own only up to the cliff. They don't own the property on top of the cliff.
At this time, because they alienated the above property.
And the same with McCormick's?
The same with McCormick's. They put themselves in this situation, and now they're looking to sue their way out over our client's land.
I mean, arguably, they would have an easement, if the property got destroyed, they would have an easement over the cliff, easement by necessity, arguably, because there was common ownership, and the separation of the properties caused it to be landed.
They may, in fact, I don't know, as I stand
from
before you today, but they may, in fact, have an easement to their property, but because of the economic argument they set forth, they're indicating they cannot use it. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel, Mr. Ross.
Thank you, members of the court. There are a number of questions that were asked of Attorney Reitz that I can answer. I've been involved with this situation and problem since 1988. This case has been going on quite a while. I did cite in my brief to the court that there are two prior circuit court cases in Door County, started in 1988 and in 1990. That was the defendant, Mr. Schwab, attempting through the village of Ephraim to obtain access. In response to the question of have negotiations been attempted, extensive, lengthy negotiations were attempted. To no fruition, they just weren't able to come to an agreement. To the question about 8013, does that apply to the village? I specifically argue in the circuit court case that 8013 does not apply to a village. That was one of my arguments. However, the defendant McCormick, or the plaintiff, Mrs. McCormick, her property to the north borders on the town of Liberty Grove. And the plaintiff McCormick has never attempted any action under 8013. And I think under the Bockhausen case that we have cited to you, that precludes her ability to even be before this court. So if you, and that's in the Bockhausen case. The unity of title question has come up a lot. And I think you have to read the case of Rock Lakes Estates. Let me give Rock Lake Estates Unit Owners versus Lake Mills, 195 with second 348. That is a Court of Appeals case decided in 1995. And in that case, we have the federal government was not a party to that case. It was a private party. One individual owned a large parcel, sold off the access, and retained the landlocked portion, and then sued the owners of the access parcel saying, oops, I forgot to retain an easement. The court in that case said, that's just the opposite of your common ownership grantor grantee where the landlocked portion is sold and the grantor retains the access parcel. They said, under those facts, which is the facts we have in this case, an easement by necessity is not to be granted. They're not entitled to it. And that's really the facts of our case. If by the pleadings in the complaint, Lot 4 was sold first. The federal government sold the access, retained its landlocked parcel. Did it retain an easement? No. And I think it'd be impractical to ask the federal government to retain an easement. And the reason being is...
Just a second. Don't confuse me here. At the time the government sold Lot 4, they did not retain landlocked property because lots 2 and 3 were not landlocked.
That's correct.
I want to make sure of that point.
The argument, and that's part of my argument that I have made to the court, that the parcel in its entirety did have access. What the plaintiffs are asking this court to do is say, not look at the parcel in whole, we have to look at each and every piece of it to see if each and every piece of a property sold off has access. That's the argument in this case, and I think that's an unreasonable burden to put on anybody to have to go and check that out. There's another rule of law that we have to keep in mind here. What the petitioners are asking the court to do is extend an existing easement. That's made clear. I think everybody understands that. The rule of law in Wisconsin, found both in the Guzzi versus Flora case that I cited in my brief and Sitchio versus Albee, is that you have no right to extend an easement beyond the property to which it's granted. That's clear. In order for the court to do what the petitioners are asking, you have to overrule that law or change it. But that law has been in existence
Since the early 1900s, that law has never been changed. That's a hurdle the petitioners have to get over. There's also been the question about balancing of equities. The petitioners have alleged in their complaint that it's of little harm to the defendants to grant this easement. Again, that's contrary to existing Wisconsin law. Again, the Guzzi case has said there is no balancing of equities. Also, the Sitchio case said easements cannot be extended to additional land even though there is no additional burden. So there is no balancing that the petitioners are asking this court to do. In order to exercise the balancing of equities, again, this court is going to have to change some very long-standing law that's been around in this state. But if let's assume we can get through all of those hurdles, and that there was at some time an implied easement here. It's sitting inchoate, basically hidden. Nobody knows about it. And why doesn't anybody know about it? Let's look at the facts. If we look at the plaintiff's deeds or the defendant's deeds, no reference to an easement granted to the petitioners. Rule number one, that's where you have to look. Rule number two, let's go to the courthouse. Let's see if we can find anything by looking at the property that we're interested in to see if there's any notice to us that there's some adverse interest. You will not find that. I don't know of any way, and I've been searching titles in real estate for 20 years or better. I do a lot of real estate work. You cannot search in the courthouse geography. You may find a survey, if you're lucky, that might have a bluff line drawn in it. It never tells you how high that bluff is. It's only recently that you start to see topographical surveys that will show you variances in land height, but that's not something that's recorded, and it's not required, and you don't see it, and it's definitely not in existence in this case. But let's assume all of those things, we can get through all of those hurdles, there was an implied easement. We also have a set of law in this state under the Schmidt versus Hilti lumber case and Ludke versus Egan that a bona fide purchaser for value, if they have no notice of any adverse right, take free and clear of that. You have to think back on our law. Our recording law in this state is a notice state. Three statutes are important in that. 70608, which defines a bona fide purchaser. 70609, that defines affirmative notice. And also section 89315, that puts a limitation on adverse rights out there. And why do we have these statutes? It's so that hidden rights go away, so that we can have a good marketable title, so that somebody, when they buy a piece of property, aren't buying a lawsuit. And that's what's happened in this case. If we look at the definition of what is good marketable title, that definition goes back to 1931. And that's the definition says that you're buying property free of litigation, that you can enjoy it peacefully and quietly, and that its title is not subject to judicial review or doubt. To allow what the petitioners are asking will subject a great portion of rural Wisconsin to doubt. And I believe the case is Bockhausen for one, said that is an unreasonable burden to put on any owners of property.
Mr. Ross?
Yes.
Could you succinctly explain why the parties were never able to get together?
Well, first of all, you have 19 defendants, none of whom reside there permanently. These are all summer homes, and they reside all over the place. We were fortunate to have one retired attorney who is one of the defendants here. He's now deceased. He did make valiant efforts to try and get this done. Just with 19 personalities, it just didn't work. They were concerned, clearly, about how this road would be used.
because as Attorney Reitz has described the road, I've been down this road many, many times. And it is, in fact, a one-lane road. And if you understand the geography, where our clients reside, there is also a bluff. There's a high bluff, which is the same bluff that the McCormick and Schwab property have. But then where this road is, sits on a plateau. And then most of the homes of my clients are built on another, below another bluff. This road can't be expanded. You can't go to the west towards the water because you're going over a cliff. You can't go to the east because you're going into a bluff. This road can't be widened. And I'll tell you, that was part of the reason that the village, in its case, where I was involved as one of the attorneys, said this can't be a public road. It's under the public road statutes, it has to be a three-rod road. We cannot make it a three-rod road. It's physically impossible. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ross. Mr. Lyons, you have a few minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. First of all, I will answer the Chief Justice's question in just one second, but I would like to quote from a 1974 case of this court in which the common enemy doctrine was done away with for the reasonable use doctrine. At that time, the court stated, when a rule of law thwarts social policy rather than promotes it, it is the obligation of a common law court to undo or modify a rule that has been previously made. And I think that's what we're talking about here. When we talk about... We're talking about this property. The fact that these lots were back to the right, to the east, is immaterial. We did not bring this action in the trial court, and we did not bring the petition for review because this issue has absolutely nothing to do with the property above the cliff. The strict language that these properties were not landlocked at the time of the transfer is in fact true, the strict language. The practical aspect of today's society tells us that they were landlocked below the cliff. These properties, a question was asked on the size of these properties, the depth of these properties. These properties are very deep up here, they're deep down here. And I've been along that road, and it is a one-lane road. And to say that there's going to be a substantial development up here going over this is just not true. My client's property is subdivided, zoned for three single-family homes. These are all, as Mr. Ross just told you, these are summer cottages. It's anticipated that that's what these will be up here. But in no way, Mr. Justice, that have I ever made the position that we were dealing with anything but that property below the cliff.
Counsel, when, in order to employ the doctrine of easement by necessity, you need unity in title, you need common ownership. Seems to me, if indeed, although you say they're immaterial, if indeed that there was not a landlocked state when the properties were separated, then what you're really asking us to do is to do away with the requirement even of common ownership. And that what you really want us to say is, look, if properties are landlocked, regardless of common ownership or common ownership by the United States, if they're landlocked, that's against public policy and you should do something about it.
In its strictest form, you're absolutely right. But I don't think that the court need go that far at this time because of the geographical aspect. And I would purport, Your Honor, that at this point in time, there are a number of properties throughout the state of Wisconsin that will end up in this situation where there is property remote.
But in a geographical argument, you still are arguing easement by necessity, which gets you back into the unity of title and common interest.
Well,
and you've got problems with that factually. If they're, when they were originally conveyed by the common owner, they weren't landlocked?
There's no question there is problem with that, and that's why we're asking a drastic expansion of that doctrine. Right now, I do not believe that the common ownership is relevant today. And the reason I don't believe it's relevant, because I think the public policy of having no landlocked property far outweighs any other policies. And the reason it does is, even 1942, when the Backhausen case came down, there wasn't the zoning, the environmental regulations that there are today. And that's what has changed in our society. It's changed because these properties are zoned. Back when the United States government transferred it, or in 1942, these properties weren't zoned.
Well, Council, I mean, looking at government's lots 4 and 3, at least a good argument could be made that the value of those lots is reduced if you provide for transportation into 2 and government 2 and McCormick. I mean, traffic can be an economic determinant of value.
But, Your Honor, it's correct, and it gets to the point of the notice requirement. It is minimal, the detriment, and that's why I'm asking the court to use the balancing test, because what happens is when you look at the notice requirement, if the government, the state of Wisconsin, sited a landfill next to a property, guess what? The property would lose some economic value. I think we can all agree with that. But does the property owner have notice of that? Could he or she go to any register of deeds and check that out? No. In our mobile society, in which lands are being developed every day, there's a buyer beware to a certain aspect. Now, we try to control that through zoning, through environmental regulations, but we don't control it completely. You take some risk. And in this situation, the balancing of that risk versus the benefit to having those properties open is the issue for this court.
Justice Babbitt.
One last shot. This is a roll of the dice for both parties coming to this court. So one's going to lose and one's going to win.
Absolutely.
Is there any chance that if this court should delay its decision or request further mediation, is there any...
Judge, I would not only ask, I would be very much in favor of that. In fact, when this court granted our petition for review, we wrote counsel and said that the Supreme Court, now that they've granted the petition for review, can we sit down and talk about this? Absolutely no response. We have had, I think Mr. Ross correctly stated it, but he stated it without telling the entire situation. My client, since 1974, has been beating his head against the wall in order to try to get access to this property. We have done everything humanly possible. We've gone up and down the roads. We've enlisted one of the people on the roads to help. We at one point in time had easements from an agreement for easements from a number of parties, and what happened was that one of the parties said that I'm going to be the last one. And then guess what? Another one said I'm going to be the last one. So we end up with more than one being the last one, and it doesn't work. We have done everything we can, and if the court would order mediation and order all the parties to mediation, we would be very, very thankful. In fact, we have proposed, compensation, if that is what is needed in order to compensate Mr. Lenz for some access or some problem with the road. The other people, there have always been this, our hands have been open to that.
The court as a rule, it's at least been used in the trial court, and we too have used it once and have suggested mediation, and the parties flew back into our laps. So we have been 100% unsuccessful, just to let the parties know.
Yeah. Well, the number of respondents is our problem.
Counsel, thank you. Both of you, the court is adjourned until the December sitting.
Thank you. Thank you.